Hey, everybody. Happy 2014. We're back, Scene Stealers. And it's been since October since we were on here. So if you don't know who I am, I'm Trevin McGee.
And obviously, Trevin can't remember how to do this.
No, it's been so long. But I'm here with Trey Hawk, who just pointed out my faults, which is his default mode.
Standard.
And Eric Moline.
Hi.
And we're going to talk about the best movies of 2013. That's all we're going to talk about today. So we've all made top 10 lists. We've already voted. The Kansas City Film Critics Circle has decided. We've all made our decisions on the best films for 2013. And we're going to go over that now, starting with number 10.
And who did the Kansas City Film Critics Circle pick as best picture?
Best director. Best director was a tie.
Actor, best supporting actor. And best supporting actress. What film are those picks? And also best screenplay.
I believe it was...
Adapted screenplay.
Yeah.
Adapted screenplay. I think it was Gangster Squad. I think Gangster Squad ran away with it this year.
It was 12 Years a Slave. It was
Home Alone 2.
Which is a fine film, but apparently it's better than everything else in a million categories.
Man, you are bitter about
it
that.
It cracks me up.
Be
you
happy.
Want the smorgasbord. Yeah. Instead of being okay with one film being a standout.
When one thing is the best at a bunch of things, it deserves to be heralded as such.
But
let's spread it around. No, they weren't as good as the other things. You know, if they had been as good as the other things, they would have won.
It's just frustrating because the KC film critics have long had a history of not going with what everybody else says.
Like when we named Hugo the science fiction film of the year.
Hey, like that was
that brilliant move.
Let's
look on the bright side,
fantasy.
All right?
Yeah,
it is fantasy. Whatever.
Well, did you see the broadcast film critics?
No.
They nominated Gravity as best, which is another group I'm a voting member of.
Yeah, and that's why I don't follow.
Gravity as best sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
And Sandra Bullock as best action actress in an action movie, but Gravity not as an action movie.
Nice.
Well, yeah,
and
we said in the critics circle
with KC, we said that her was best sci-fi, and we disqualified Gravity as not being a science fiction movie because it could take place today.
Yeah, despite what Neil deGrasse Tyson would have us think.
About sight lines and
about
and
everything
physics.
That happens in that movie. The satellites are...
The weightlessness of her hair.
Yeah. But let's focus on some positives. Naming her as the science fiction film of the year, that was a great move. I was really happy about
and
that.
And screenplay.
That was really great. It was a good year. Pretty much everything that I believe deserved credit got it. And, it was a tough year to decide, but 12 Years a Slave really connected with people, so I don't have a problem with that. Number 10, though... I want to start with, you guys have your phones out, so I'm going to pick Trey. I'm going to pick Trey to tell me what his number 10 movie of the year is.
Well, I took a different tact this year, and because so many really great films that were on my legitimate top 10 list were getting a lot of praise, I decided to focus on underrated films this year. Films that in normal years would kind of be the cream of the crop, but because this year was so strong and so packed with real contenders, I decided to kind of take a look at my second tier of films. So my top 10 is a top 10 of underrated films. And the first film that I have on that list is Spring Breakers, which I believe is also on Eric's top 10. So
it's in mine.
We'll talk about that, at length later on. But this was a film that came out early on, was a real standout, does some really amazing things, and I can't wait to get kind of full into depth
one
discussion.
Thing. One thing.
Yeah, one thing that really blew you away about Spring Breakers. It's not like an in-depth dive of commentary or everything.
Just a sort of subversive social commentary that most people will totally miss.
Like the four people in the screening that I saw it with in Denver.
Yeah.
It was me and four other people, and as we were walking out of the theater, they were like, so was that supposed to be funny or what?
Well, I mean...
If you have to ask if something's funny, it typically isn't. That's like when someone says, that's hilarious, instead of laughing. It's like, just fucking laugh if it's funny. that's the correct response.
Yeah, to be honest, it's like me and all of the critics I saw it with.
Yeah. Mean Maline?
Yeah.
World champion air guitarist.
That was what I would have liked to have seen was James Franco, best supporting actor at the KC Film Critics Circle. There was a small core of us that were going for that, but it didn't quite work.
No.
My number 10 is a movie that I don't think appears on either of your guys' lists.
Mm-hmm.
Ain't Them Body Saints.
Ooh, yeah.
This is directed by David Lowery. It came out of Sundance this past year. Stars Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara as these two outlaws, I guess you could say. Not really outlaws, but they rob a bank. They need money at the beginning of the movie. The star of this movie is really the cinematography and the mood. The setting of the film, it's sometime in maybe the 50s or 60s in Texas. We don't really know for sure. Ben Foster has an amazing supporting role. It's one of those...
He's consistently fantastic,
and the
by
thing
the
is,
way.
Is, you know, I watched like, the movie, and I'm thinking, this guy's great.
Yeah.
And then the credits roll, and I was like, oh, that was Ben Foster.
Yeah.
I didn't even know it was
he
him.
He put a bunch
and
of
know,
weight on, and he just changed his look completely.
People,
yeah.
I was a little embarrassed, kind of like when Roger Ebert saw Monster and had no idea it was Charlize Theron until the credits rolled.
Yeah.
But no, I think Ain't Them Body Saints is a real good kind of American mythic kind of folk tale about, you know, doomed love. And I really like the – a lot of people call it Terrence Malick light. And my friends here will accuse me of being of having a boner for Malick,
yeah,
most of the time.
That's the
and
technical
I do.
Term. Yeah.
But To the Wonder's not on my list this year, and Ain't Them Body Saints is.
It is a more Terrence Malick film than the Terrence Malick film that came out.
More Malick than yeah. Malick.
More Malick than Malick.
I think that's being a little reductionary, but
sure.
I do
it's,
understand
yeah,
why
it's a
they
cop
say
out.
It.
It's yeah. a total cop out.
Well, Malick has grown in a certain direction, and this film is kind of a.
Hey, remember
almost,
Badlands?
That's yeah,
kind of, that's
it,
kind of
it,
what the movie
yeah.
is like.
I mean, it sort of is. It's a throwback to what Malick used to do. And he's, I think, in a different place, has kind of grown in a...
Bigger concerns?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you know, I enjoyed that film when it came out. And it is definitely a performance film. And actually, over the break, I caught Assassination of Jesse James on TV, like on IFC,
yeah.
just kind of trolling through channels. I forgot how many fantastic performances are in that film, including Casey Affleck, and
yeah.
he's great in Ain't Them Bodies. So it's definitely one of those that I think it hit a chord with certain people, but it never really found the sort of wide stream.
Yeah, and
I think
it is
a
great performance film, but I want to stress the cinematography and the mood and the editing style and the way that it's all put together. I think that's the real star of the film, and there's something kind of timeless about it. That's
yeah.
the other thing that I really liked about it.
For sure.
The moments of big moments of conflict are actually not on screen, but all the moments surrounding them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really interesting way to put a movie together. So Ain't Them Body Saints is my number 10.
Yep. And my number 10 is another one that's not on anyone else's list. My number 10 is The Place Beyond the Pines.
Yeah.
Derek C. N. France's, yeah. Derek C. N. France's follow up to Blue Valentine. I loved how the marketing and advertising positioned the film as being a sort of Ryan Gosling vehicle, and instead it was much more ambitious and was really about, you know, fathers and sons and the legacy and the damage that's left behind in the wake of, you know, your decisions matter, and when children come into play, not only do your mistakes affect your life, but they affect the lives of those around
you.
The
sins of the father.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I really, there's elements of almost Greek tragedy minus the incest in that film, but there is a lot of repercussions and tragic irony that takes place in it. In my original review, I gave Mike Patton way too much credit for the soundtrack, because he is responsible for all of the boring stuff. They reuse this Ennio Morricone song three or four times to tie Gosling character relationship to Eva Mendes, and then that same relationship to her son, who's played by Dean DeHaan. And that's a really useful piece of music throughout the film. And being ignorant, I thought that was Mike Patton, because it's not even listed in the credits. I had to like find it later in the actual film soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
I applauded the film for its ambition, and it's another one that's I think is kind of a sleeper, but was disappointed in. I think some things work really well in it, and I think sometimes it gets a little over ambitious, or it just kind of shows his weaknesses as an early director. I think that he's going to be a great... I think he is a good director now. I think he's going to be a great director as he moves forward. Kind of like Steve McQueen, who, after his first movie, like, I can see where this guy's going. I mean, it's not quite the same to compare them. McQueen's on a different level, but
I wish it took a few films. A screenplay nod. Nobody is talking about it for the screenplay. It's a completely 100% linear screenplay with essentially three different stories that have interlocking characters.
Yep.
And it's not often that you see that these days. We have a lot of flashbacks. We have a lot of messing with time. And none of that stuff happens in this movie. And because of that, I thought it was really rigid but focused. And so I know a lot of people didn't like that about it. So that's maybe why it's not getting credit. But I think it should get a screenplay.
And the emotional arc that takes place in it is really amazing. How, you're right, it is chronologically linear.
Yeah.
But this emotional arc that takes place over these, and I would call them four stories. I've heard a number of people talk about it as three stories, and the third being the two sons.
Mm-hmm.
But really, I think each gets their moment. And so really, it's over four stories. But there is this completely satisfying emotional arc that takes place over the course of all four of the individual stories. I think it's really a pretty stunning accomplishment, and I would agree with you that it really is determined in the screenplay, and then it's just a matter of executing. And I think Cian France does a really great job in his direction.
That naturalistic style again. Yeah. And it just works. Great.
And also being a big fan of when that marriage of like performance and cinematography, and then having the perfect song for a moment. Like, that's one of the reasons I love Scorsese so much. It's one of the reasons I love David O. Russell so much. I love the ending of this movie so much. And I don't even like Bon Iver, but the last, 30 seconds of that movie is.
He's so sad, Bon Iver.
But I love the way that film concludes. That's one of my favorite endings of the year. And I think, and on this, I'll move on after this. But I think if it hadn't been for American Hustle, there'd be some more talk about Bradley Cooper in this film, because he is, talk about a guy who's transitioned from being just like a pretty boy, I'll be in the A team and you know crap like that, to he's a full blown comedic dramatic actor now, and he's great in Place Beyond the Pines, and you know he's great in American Hustle, but we'll talk more about that later. Trey, what's your number nine?
My number nine, well, underrated.
Number nine?
Is, I actually paired Spring Breakers with this film, which is The Bling Ring, because I think they make a really interesting duo. I don't think The Bling Ring is on either one of your lists.
No.
Harmony Korine kind of offers you this mad, crazy fairy tale, and Sofia Coppola offers you this subtle, subversive drama in The Bling Ring. But I think that they both kind of walk hand in hand.
I would say that they're both subversive comedies, though. Believe it or not, I think The Bling Ring is a comedy. Because we're not, I don't think that we're meant to take the people as, you know, I don't know. I still think that she's trying to make a comment, I guess.
I think she is trying to make a comment.
On society, of course.
I don't know. And maybe it's just her style, that her style has become more and more understated. But that I think the comment doesn't hit me as funny. And I think that the people who really missed the mark on this one, who really didn't, and I know you liked The Bling Ring, but I think that there were a couple of people who just missed the boat on The Bling Ring, and I think that they were looking for it to be funny, openly funny. And it's not that way. That if it's...
I disagree. I thought it was openly funny. There were a lot of
I mean, there were things that I thought were funny.
Where they would just say something completely absurd.
And I agree. I agree. But I think you're always laughing at them.
Yeah. I mean, certainly more with the Leslie Mann character and, and her the way she treats her kids. But
is it better to be laughing in a situation like this? Because this will come up when we talk about Wolf of Wall Street, too. But is it better to be laughing at the character or with the character in a film like this?
I think if it's intended as a comedy, you're at least balancing between laughing with and laughing at. And I would say more on the side of laughing with.
Well,
there's
not,
some intentionality.
It's not without empathy, that's for sure. We do feel for the kids because of a certain amount of loneliness. And honestly, the characters in The Bling Ring...
Yeah.
she spends, Sofia Coppola spends more time trying to make them characters than Harmony Korine does trying to make Absolutely. Those people, actual yeah. characters.
Yeah.
We still don't even know at the end of Spring Breakers what some of their names are. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
We
absolutely.
Spent the whole movie with them, and we're like, the girl in the pink bikini, the girl in yeah. the green bikini. Or,
sure.
So it is, but it just doesn't have the flair.
Yeah.
There's something about it that's lacking, and I think you hit the nail on the head when you said it was maybe too subtle for some people.
Right. And I mean, I think of shots when they break into that one house
yeah,
so in the great. Hill, and
yeah.
and,
oh,
you're
yeah,
looking
the camera
through
stays
and it's
outside.
This total glass house.
Harris
yeah.
Sabidas.
Yeah.
yeah.
And the camera stays outside, and you're just looking at them in this long shot moving through this house, and the sound design is
yeah.
really understated. It's just amazing.
Now, he died on this film. This was his last movie.
Yeah.
The cinematographer, Harris Sabidas, and that was one of the shots that he did, but they had to finish up the movie after he passed.
Yeah.
So...
I just think that this is a film that I think maybe it's understatement, maybe it's control, maybe it's subtlety, just didn't, you know,
it's
didn't
perfect
connect
with
for
something. Underrated list.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it will find an audience, like a bigger, I think it's going to have a bigger life on DVD, and especially whenever it shows up on Netflix or whatever.
I love how Sofia Coppola seems to be really digging her heels in as far as a director too.
Yeah.
So just doing her thing.
Mr. Moline?
Yes, sir.
What's your number 9?
My number 9 is Nebraska.
Ah.
Is that
I think you're the only man. So we can
are.
Get into
yeah.
Nebraska
so,
pretty deep.
So here's the thing with Nebraska, and it was teetering at the bottom of my list,
mm-hmm.
9, 10, 11, 12, until I saw it a second time. And when I saw it a second time, I realized that it was going to be easy for me to forgive some of the broader comedic moments that June Squibb has in this movie
sure.
as Bruce Stern's wife, overbearing wife, and Will Forte's mother, such as the scene where she lifts her skirt up at the cemetery. There's a couple of moments in the movie where I suppose you could say that it jives with the rest of what her character says, but when I viewed the film a second time, apart from all the melancholy and the sadness that I felt the first time, and I was able to know the characters going in and see how they were portrayed from the beginning after already knowing them instead
yeah.
of getting to know them the first time, she seemed way more within that range. Like I could totally believe what was doing. And she was the part of the film that kind of drove me crazy the first time.
Yeah.
Now seeing it again and being able to concentrate on Bruce Dern's journey as this guy who says so much without saying hardly anything, with just his eyes and the way he holds himself, the things that he chooses to respond to and not to respond to,
mm-hmm.
and his curt responses that sometimes say so much more than anything else. I think it's a really terrifically written movie from Bob Nelson. This is the first movie that Payne hasn't at least had a hand in co-writing.
Right.
And honestly, I found it to be, and this will be a theme with another film on all of our lists, or on both of your lists, I found it to be even funnier the second time. So it's almost like when you embrace the sadness and you embrace the melancholy, then you can stand back a little further and laugh at the absurdity of it all.
Sure.
I love the fact that he used amateur actors, and I love the fact that he shot in black and white in Nebraska,
mm-hmm.
All these people there. And there was so much in there that rings true from this kind of Midwest stoic behavior that I've seen in my own family.
You feel like it's poking fun of that culture, though.
I don't.
Bit.
No, I don't. Just like I don't think Fargo's poking fun. It's light.
I mean,
fun.
I'm genuinely asking. I'm not trying
yeah,
to walk
yeah.
you
no, no,
into
no.
something.
It's light fun, if anything. But don't we lightly poke fun at everybody?
Yeah. If it's poking fun, it's poking fun from within. That's
yeah.
the way I would characterize it. Is that it feels like
I know these characters,
yeah,
so
it,
I don't
it,
feel like they're caricatures.
Yeah.
Although the June Squibb character in a couple scenes
she,
did get over
yeah,
the top.
Yeah, it, you should watch August Osage County then and feel
I
if
hold,
that's like
yeah,
real
I
characters.
Hold June Squibb more accountable for the where
her
I see
her
that
delivery
is.
Was so unique and so great for most of the film. It was just when she went overboard, and I don't know if that stuff was scripted
even,
or not.
But even at the beginning when she's yelling at him from the doorway, I mean, in the driveway.
Have you seen it twice yet?
Check it out
the second time, because as soon as I heard her, I'm like, oh yeah, well there she
I
is.
Have
and
it
I
very
know.
Specifically in my head though. So
okay,
yeah.
But then one last thing I wanted to say about Nebraska is that there's an actress in the film who appears in a couple scenes, And the one that I'm thinking of is when Will Forte goes to the newspaper
right.
and starts talking to her. And she was a local actress from Nebraska as well. I think she's actually from L.A. I can't remember her name. It's Angela something McEwen, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just this moment that crosses on her face. And everything that you need to know about people's lives being lived, you can see in her eyes mm-hmm. in that moment. And I think this whole movie is about what your family doesn't know about you. And Bruce Dern says so much in this film. I hope he gets a much-deserved Best Actor nomination. And again, for people who didn't like it the first time, it really sat with me better a second time and moved up on my list.
So if you didn't like it the first time, spend money and see it again.
No, you should see it again.
I liked it the first time too, but it grew in my.
Well, that's happened. Actually, I'm just causing trouble, but that's happened to me several times on this list. Like when you and I walked out of Llewyn Davis, we were both kind of like, I don't know. I mean, I liked it, but I was trying to figure out why I kept thinking about it and resonating with me. And it took a few more viewings to really get that nailed down. So
the last thing I want to mention is there's no room for him in any of the awards talk this year, but Will Forte, just spectacular.
He's surprisingly good.
He's really good.
Surprisingly good in this
movie. I hope he has a good long post SNL career that's not just like...
I wish him a very long life. And happy new year.
Happy new year, Will Forte. My number 9, and this was hard to decide between 8 and 9 order-wise, but my number 9 is Stoker. And I don't know if that's on anyone else's list.
It's on my underrated list.
Trey's underrated.
But if you want, it's my number 8 on my underrated. So we can just dive in.
Yeah,
Let's just tag team that.
So Stoker.
We're going to tag team Stoker.
Oh, God. That's the sequel. We mentioned Stoker earlier how Spring Breakers was such a visual movie. And Ain't Them Body Saints, especially, was such a visually told movie. Stoker is a performance film, but it is by far more...
It's a director's film more than anything, but
visually it tells a story way better than with its performances. It could almost be a silent movie, honestly.
I put Nicole Kidman on my Critics' Choice ballot as number 1 for supporting actress, knowing full well that she wasn't going to get it.
No.
That's a pretty great choice.
She was amazing in that.
Matthew Good is amazingly aloof and bizarre, and you know, he's traditionally handsome, but there's just something off about him. Everything about that movie is intriguing and strange.
Mia Wasikowska is amazing. All three of the characters are essentially great. Just three characters
in that film. I mean, Jackie Weaver's in it, but Harmony Korine's in it. Mm-hmm. But it's three people.
As a
high school teacher, which that'd be an interesting class. But it's just those three, and the story that's told, and the way that it's told, and that sort of like transition into adulthood. There are so many memorable scenes. The shower scene especially is one that like will stick in your head for a while. I wanted to make a favorite scenes list for the year, and I haven't done it because I'm bad at stuff. But one of my favorite scenes from the year is definitely the scene where she's playing piano and he comes, Matthew Good's character, Uncle Charlie, comes and sits down next to her.
Oh, Uncle Charlie.
And they start playing together. It's incredibly self-aware at times. I love that scene in the staircase when he says, "Do you know why this is awkward for you? Because I'm standing above you." Like, he's acknowledging camera placement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the best Alfred Hitchcock movie that Alfred Hitchcock didn't make, as far as I'm concerned. And I enjoyed watching it, and it's the kind of film that just kind of stuck with me for a long time.
I like that you said self-aware, because there's a couple sequences in the film where they're shot like you're not supposed to shoot movies.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you've been through film school, or just if it's your thing to look at shots and know why they're there and why they're not there, you get that. But if you're not, can you imagine like just being a casual film fan and like not understanding why this scene is making you uncomfortable?
Yeah,
it's because there's all this space on the wrong side of the screen and the characters are looking in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
No.
I just wanted to say
I think it's great.
And it's a director's film, through and through, like you guys said, and just...
And almost nothing happens.
Yeah,
if you think about it. It's all menace.
And that's what's so brilliant about it, is the story is so simple.
Yeah.
It's
Shadow of a Doubt.
Yes.
It's Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt.
And you know who the bad guys are from the get-go. You know kind of what's going on from the get-go. And really what Park Chan-wook is able to do with this film... In a similar way to kind of how he was able to do it with Old Boy, although Old Boy, when the twist happens, you're just kind of like, oh my God, why have you taken me to this terrible emotional place?
Of course, we're talking about the Korean auteur and not the remake by Spike Lee.
No, yes, of course.
Although the twist is the same.
2003 right. original.
Right, but I mean, he's...
Well, he mentioned Park Chan-wook.
But as far as this film goes, he's able to do something much more subtle than he does with Old Boy, which is you've known the whole time what's going on, and your unwillingness to accept it is what kept you from believing it. And he just kind of keeps pushing and pushing and pushing until you're forced to go, oh my God, that's really what's going on.
But there is a certain amount of awareness in Mia's character that you're not expecting, and that's interesting.
Exactly.
As well.
I think this film, you had mentioned it.
She's very.
You mentioned it, but I think this film hinges on that shower scene. And when I saw it at the screening that I saw it on, as the shower scene started, I got this huge grin on my face because I knew exactly what was coming. And the reason why I had such a huge grin on my face
was because you're a sick individual.
I was waiting for exactly what I was going to get in like 30 seconds, which was all of these almost across the board, like, throughout the theater.
Stoker's considered an art film, and we saw it at the Tivoli, wonderful. Which the median age was about 50, 60, something. Yeah. So that's always fun to see that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Stoker was on my runners-up list. It barely made or didn't make my list, and had it not been for her, it was my number two choice for genre film this year.
Just so many great visual metaphors. You know, her like coming of age bit, the thing with the shoes, and
there are tons of amazing visual plants,
and it's the hardest movie to recommend to people that aren't like deep into cinema, that aren't really movie lovers. It's because I've talked about it at my work before and been like, I'm not saying go see it at all.
Yeah,
but I'm saying kind of that it was one of my favorite. You know,
you've got why don't you give me your eHarmony profile and then I can tell you whether this movie is right for you or not.
Oh, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. No, you're not gonna like this.
Yeah. What was the last good movie you saw? The King's Speech. Yeah, you're not gonna ever enjoy this.
Your number eight is American Hustle.
Oh wow!
Which I believe is going to come up on your list.
It's going to be a little higher on mine. So
what I want to say about David O. Russell's American Hustle is that this script was on the blacklist for a really long time, and it was written by a screenwriter whose name escapes me. And when David O. Russell got a hold of it, he was not the first person. It had been passed around quite a bit. When he got a hold of it, he was like, oh, this is interesting. Now let's take this Abscam scandal from New Jersey in the late 70s, and let's make these characters David O. Russell characters. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what he did. And this is a very, very funny movie, and I don't think it's getting enough credit. I think some people are writing it off as this sort of Scorsese light because of a lot of voiceover and cinematic zip pans, like Goodfellas, that kind of thing.
It is very similar. Pushes.
Yeah, but there's a lot more to that than this. And honestly, more than any other movie this year, for me, this is the movie that hinges 100% on performances.
Yeah.
If the performances weren't as good and the actors weren't as skilled at making this funny satire, this movie would not work at all. And the fact that it breezes along is kind of a testament to... To them and to Russell.
Are we
going to
talk about this more later?
Yep. Okay. Yeah, we will.
Okay.
So that's my number eight.
I just want to make sure, so otherwise I've got some stuff to get in.
Yeah.
My number eight, we already hit on. I don't know if it's going to come up again on your list, Trey, but Spring Breakers is my number eight.
No, this is, I think this is it, unless it's on yours higher.
It's higher on mine.
It's higher on Eric. So I'll touch on my one thing with the Spring Breakers is the blacklight cinematography and how
that is a beautiful,
amazingly
beautiful
visual it is. And also, it has I love specific scenes and openings and conclusions to movies like that can kind of make or break a movie for me, and it has one of my favorite opening scenes of the year, but it's because of everything that follows it that makes you pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my number eight.
Shot by the guy who did Gaspar Noé's Enter the Void.
Or yeah.
Into the Void. Is it Enter or Into the Void?
Into. Enter.
Okay. So whose name escapes me, who was amazing. And should be nominated for an Oscar.
All right.
For cinematography. Absolutely, I agree.
Trey Hawk, numero seven, lucky.
Yeah, I know this is not on anybody else's list because it made your runners up, and I know it's not on Trevin's list, and that is Only God Forgives.
Ugh. It's not on mine either, and I saw it twice.
Yeah,
yeah, I watched. It
I rewatched
Blu-ray.
It too because it's streaming on Netflix, yeah. And I was like, I'm gonna give it a third.
I rewatched it
shot.
Too.
I'm done with that movie.
All right, that's yeah. fine. That's
I love
fine.
I love looking at beautiful images that are well shot and neon lit and lots of color schemes that work well together. But no,
I love the dissension. I love the dissension.
It's so forced. At no, like Stoker feels like someone's guiding the story.
Sure, sure.
But Only God Forgives feels like somebody's jacking off onto the screen.
That's
no
the thing
purpose.
Is, it's a metaphor for that entire movie is, you know, it's masturbation without finishing. But if that was his intention, what a pretentious, shitty intention.
It wasn't his intention because I watched it again with the director's commentary on because I wanted to hear what this meant to Refn. Nicholas
sure.
Winding Refn
who was driving
director.
This boat. Yeah.
And the things that he mentioned were all so superficial and like, oh, okay, well, yeah, of course that's that. And oh, and that's it. That's it. That's all there was to it. There wasn't, there is no deeper meaning to any of it. So I appreciate the digressions and the weird places it goes, but that's a tough movie to sit through.
And it's an interesting perspective on revenge and telling revenge from the other side of a story. But
we haven't let him talk.
That's yet. Fine.
Oh, no. Well, this is cathartic. We get it all out, and then Trey's going to tell us how stupid we are.
No,
there you go. There you go.
I really am not. This is absolutely, I think of all of the films that we have on any of our lists, this is by far the most divisive. It is probably
divisive.
The most. Which one?
You're going to correct someone on how to
had
say
to be
a word.
About yeah. how he said divisive.
Well, only when I do division.
Yes.
It's also probably the most difficult to watch.
It's an exercise.
Yeah.
Sort of. I mean, and I would compare it. I think Gaspar Noé, who came up because he was a cinematographer on Spring Breakers.
Well, his cinematographer.
Right.
He. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Or yeah,
right.
His cinematographer was the cinematographer on Spring Breakers. But I think Gaspar Noé is a good comparison to a film like this with Refn. And I think this goes back to a film like Valhalla Rising. It is much more similar to that than it is to Drive, which was another film that I really appreciated. And I think that there is something, one of the things that I say about Refn in my list is that he pairs violence with other things as a way to distill your reaction to those things. And that Drive is perhaps his easiest film because it pairs violence with romantic love in kind of opposition to it. That because he allows himself to kind of help this person, he wrecks himself.
Yeah.
And in this, you're pairing deviant and restrictive sexual behaviors with violence, which is a much easier pairing, and it also is a much more sort of troubling visual pairing. And then he's making those things look rich and beautiful and amazing visually, and giving it all over to these kind of stiff and forced characters who are almost entirely emotionless. I totally agree with you. This is a very difficult film to get through. I find it completely engaging and really fascinating, and I really want there to be place in the sort of cinematic oeuvre for films like this. And that's basically my defense.
I will agree with you that there's a place for that, and that I was happy to try to engage with it, but I can only watch a perfectly set up shot of Ryan Gosling staring into the screen doing nothing for so long.
Yeah.
this movie could have been 30 minutes. You know what I mean?
Kristen Stewart Thomas?
Kristen Scott Thomas?
Scott Thomas, yeah.
Yeah.
I could watch, yeah. I could watch those shots all the time.
She has a great moment in that movie.
Brilliant.
She's chewing up the scenery. She's having a lot of fun. But here's the other thing. If the dialogue for everyone in this movie was as clever as it is for her in that one scene, it might be worth watching. But it's not. And so it's just...
I think it would have become so tiresome.
We did this before when we discussed this the first time. Yeah. I was more on your side, but kind of But after, I'm done. I'm done.
You're dead to me. Only God forgives.
I just think that Trevin made a good point earlier when he said, maybe on the last podcast, that Refn may be somebody who makes these... Because I didn't like Valhalla Rising either. Makes these hollow, beautiful-looking movies... but doesn't really have anything to say.
Yeah.
And that he's not going to be really a storyteller, but just kind of a pusher of buttons. And that Drive may be, instead of where he's headed, it may be the exception to the rule.
Yeah, so, and that's what I'm worried about.
Yeah.
But we can move on. Mr. Right. Moline, number 7.
We're not going to move on too far. We've already talked about it a little bit, and probably even enough, but it's Spring Breakers.
Okay.
It's my number 7. We haven't talked about James Franco in the film, who I think... is a lot of people don't want to give him credit for being great in this movie because it's such an over-the-top role and because his role is so different from him and it's kind of comical. And maybe it maybe seems like he's doing this one-dimensional thing. But I would point them to the scene on the bed when the girls turn the tables on him.
Yep.
And they do something in that moment. And all of a sudden, all of the archetypes that we've seen of every type of person in this movie start to gel and become real in that moment.
Yeah.
And that is the absolute turning point of the film. Up to that point in the movie, I was thinking, well, this is an interesting thing. Let's see if it goes anywhere. And from that moment on, it went to places that completely surprised and overwhelmed me. I saw this a second time last week with my girlfriend who completely enjoyed it, and I did not expect to. And we just had a ball with it. I mean, this movie, every frame of this movie is inspired. And it's pushing buttons, but I think that there's a lot of things going on too. I think there's a lot to connect it to, and maybe I just don't know enough about Thai culture, but I know a lot about American culture and the things that that Corinne is saying in this movie. As much as I think he's disconnected from reality, I don't think that there are I don't think that the youth of today is really like what he portrayed in the movie. I think this is a hyper real version of that. I don't think the Jesus freaks are like that. I don't think that the crazy spring breakers are like this either. There's probably some more realistic thing in the middle, but this movie is not interested in realism.
No.
You can tell that from the cinematography. So anybody that tries to say, well, it would never happen, isn't really thinking about what's in front of them. And I just think it was a really, really great subversive film, and I think it does
have a
lot
to say. You
mean
that
shot
with the Ferrari at the end won't ever really happen? Are you kidding me?
No.
Like, that's my fucking life.
I will say this. It also makes the greatest use of montage I've seen in a film, and it's completely made by the editing.
Yeah.
Because there's so many themes running throughout this film, and moments where he's picking from in the chronological timeline, instead of flashing back, you know, 6 months or something like that, he's flashing forward 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 40 minutes, and then he's going back 10 more. And you've already seen, the scene has just started, and you've already seen how it's going to end, but you don't know how it got there, and he's throwing the moments in the middle.
Yeah.
And it's just fascinating because it all works.
Yeah.
I think this Corinne is leaps and bounds from where he used to be. This is a big step forward for him.
I mean, you mentioned it when you talked about Refn, but you talk about like a button pusher.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. I would put Corinne in that category.
He was a button pusher, but this actually felt like he had something to say.
He's gone from abrasive to subversive.
Yeah.
Is where he is gone.
And, to plug another piece of content on our site, like, you know, Trey's interview with him is great because it really does demonstrate that he actually knows what he's doing.
But that he's also aware of it.
He's aware of it. And what
sometimes people are doing something intuitively that they aren't intellectually aware of.
Right.
He totally is intellectually
totally
aware of it. But he's also not willing to give up the goods either in an interview because he knows that the movie can stand on its own.
Yeah,
so
right.
So that's my number 7. Where are you at?
Mine is one that I know we'll be talking about later on your list, so I'll just be brief with it. Mine is a little film called The Act of Killing. And the to do just a one thing, it's a really broad one thing, but I loved just how unapologetically original it is in its idea and then the way that it carries it out, that it's a documentary and at the same time it plays in this sort of fictive world, you know, and really hard to forget.
Like
movie.
Another documentary that we'll be talking about on Trey's List.
Sure. Yeah. Really difficult to forget. So we'll dig into it more when it pops up on yours. But Act of Killing. And that was a hard one to place because you'll see what I put ahead of it and I go back and forth on my order. Trey, let's go to your number six.
Sure.
Last of this half of the podcast.
And my number six on the underrated list, I put Francis Ha. I've been a huge fan of Noah Baumbach's for a significant period of time, and also been a fan of Greta Gerwig. And this is just them at their... The story is simple, it's elegant, it's poignant, and it's just very charming. And it's just really well told. And it's a great story for those who have chosen sort of creative fields or who are artists and are in their late 20s or 30s or 40s, because this shows a group of young postgraduates struggling to kind of maintain some artistic integrity and the compromises that they're just, that everybody to some extent is forced to make.
Is he poking fun at them though, or is he?
No. It's very much sort of sympathetic. The voice is very sympathetic. It's funny, but it's in some ways it's sort of gallows humor. And what's up on the gallows is your artistic integrity.
Right.
And he's like, yeah, we're going to have to get rid of this at some point.
Sounds like another movie that we saw this year as well.
Yeah. This
the
is
Coen Brothers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
I don't hear any money in this. I don't hear any money in this.
I don't see a lot of money in this.
And this one is very specifically, it's told through the friendship between these two women. One kind of jumps off the boat very quickly. The other tries to kind of hold fast. And you then get to sort of see as they sort of rekindle their friendship later in the film, they kind of discuss the pros and cons of both sides of that. And it's really just touching and simple and relatively straightforward, but really well told. I thought it was excellent.
Awesome. I missed it when it came out, but it's already on Netflix streaming, and I watched it a few weeks ago, and I think it was like 2 a.m, and I texted Dre when it was over because I knew how much you liked it, and I loved it too. So yeah. I think it's a fantastic film, and it's just my list was pretty much solid already, so I didn't really have any room for it, but it's great. And again, great performances, and it's hard not to love Greta Gerwig after this movie. Mean Maline,
number six. The Wolf of Wall Street.
Ah.
Is this your number six, too?
No.
Okay.
It comes up a little later.
Well, let's just do this, then. We'll talk about it on the next podcast.
Hey.
Nice.
How's that?
Sounds good.
How's that for my one thing?
I love that.
And mine, we'll talk about the next on the next podcast, too, because mine is Inside Llewyn Davis. So, Coen Brothers.
Actually, that's the only time it comes up. Because it's not on my underrated. And it's not
it,
on
this
Eric's.
Is it?
No,
okay,
it.
Wow. Then I'll go into it.
Let's end this one with Llewyn Davis.
All right. Well, I never thought that I would put a Coen Brothers movie below the top five, but it just barely missed out because of some other things.
Have you seen The Lady Killers? Sorry.
The Intolerable Cruelty. It's actually really good, actually. It's a really good screwball comedy. And even Lady Killers is good, but whatever.
It has moments.
Inside Llewyn Davis, beautifully shot. It's hard to pick something out about this film that's unique to this film in terms of what the Coen Brothers do right, because it does feel very much like a Coen Brothers film. Beautifully shot, put together. The acting is naturalistic, believable, interesting. You don't think so?
No, I don't think the acting is naturalistic at all.
I think it's very controlled. I think it's contrived, but I think it's beautifully contrived. That's the way I would put it.
Okay.
I think that people, a lot of people are saying that it's naturalistic, and here's why I think they are. And that is because
saying which part, the whole film or just the
just in the performances that are given. I think it's a hyper-constructed film.
Yeah.
But I love that construction. I found it poignant. I found it beautiful. I found it incredible. It's like hearing rhyming poetry that you forget that it's rhyming.
Yeah,
that's the way I looked at this film. I think the reason why so many people are saying that, man, this just feels so real, feels like what's going on is happening, it's gets back at the performances.
The real D3D.
Yes, it is the IMAX 3D that is just really, it's jumping off the screen.
You feel the desperation,
it's the captured performances.
The performances are
that were captured.
I read an interview with the Coen brothers.
And again, are you talking about the musical performances,
the musical
or
performances,
the actual acting?
I'm talking about the acting.
Okay, I was talking about the acting too.
Yeah, the acting is not naturalistic. Each person in this film represents a very specific archetype from 1961 in the folk scene. Or outside of the folk scene, in the spirit of Garrett Hedlund as the beat poet, and John Goodman as the Doc Pomus heroin-addicted jazz dude,
right,
who has no tolerance for folk singers. G, C, G, D,
and G, hey, what you
doing? But even the scene where he goes into the office to talk to his agent, this hilarious, fucking perfectly written scene between the secretary and the guy that runs the label. And then you see the caricatures on the wall of him with the cigar and the big glasses, the Jewish guy. I mean, everything in this movie is a caricature.
Sure.
And the first time I saw it, it was just up on the screen. It was just caricatures. It just played that way. It was a typical Coen Brothers road trip movie. It was another, they even mentioned Ulysses. It's another like Oh Brother, where they're on this big Homeric journey, and the person comes to a realization at the ending and goes through all these horrible things that happen, and they just punish their character. And the first time I saw it, that's all I saw in it. And that is what you call a Coen Brothers thing. You say this is a very Coen-like film.
Yeah.
But there's something about this. I've seen it three times now. Mm-hmm. And there's something about the music and what the music does to you and the spirit and the lyrics that they've chosen in these traditional songs to kind of illustrate what's going on in Llewyn Davis's mind, where this is now, for me, somehow, despite all those larger-than-life performances, because of the one soulful performance by Oscar Isaac at the center of the film, I feel like that really brings the whole thing to life, and it makes it a little bit easier for me to swallow that Carey Mulligan is playing one note in this film and just fucking screaming at him the whole time and yelling this ridiculous stuff.
Except the apartment.
Yeah, right, you took issue with that when we were on the phone, and I don't. That's,
but
doesn't
I just,
really do that for me.
I can't really explain why this movie works, other than while I was watching it the third time, I kept going, oh, I love this scene. And then the next scene would stop. Oh, I love this scene. Oh, I can't wait for this scene. And then, oh, I love this moment. And it's just everything works from moment to moment. And at the end of it, you have to decide for yourself, was this horrible week in the life of this musician who's struggling with artistic integrity versus commerce.
Well, he's about to quit.
Yeah, it's an argument that he has with the Carey Mulligan character at the coffee shop.
Right.
And the Coens, in usual style, the thesis of their movie, they play for laughs.
Yeah.
It's like, these guys can't be serious about anything.
Yeah.
And even in that one moment where he's talking about defining his life and what he's worked for, this career, he's still making light of it, and she's still making fun of him. Neither one of them can talk about it in a serious manner.
And then they find the cat. Like,
yeah, well, yeah. And then they find the cat.
And that interrupts the entire conversation.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, is it's just such a well-written movie, and then they just, I don't know. This film,
I compared this to a more mature Barton Fink. Yeah. Because Barton Fink has all of, like, your critique that you levied against this, you absolutely could levy against Barton Fink.
But Barton Fink's also a satire, because it's making
fun of
the
people. So is this. This is totally a satire at times.
But I think the distinction is Barton Fink is the anger of a young artist.
Yeah.
It is the anger of
the misplaced
young artist.
Anger.
Yeah, yeah. That it's like, why are you fighting this system that you don't even want to be a part of?
And he thinks
to be
that he's
a part
speaking
of
for the common man, but he doesn't know shit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
it's kind of like
it is the Barton Fink is the young artist, the angry, pissed off, I'm going to change the world young artist.
This he gets is the shit kicked out of him too.
Yeah, he does. He does. I mean, and this is the melancholy of the old artist.
Yeah.
And I think both of them. I think you can actually... Barton Fink has been a film of the Coen brothers that I have really appreciated for a significant period of time. And it's not one that you can often bring up in polite conversation because people kind of look at you and go, you like Barton Fink?
And then they'll adjust their monocle.
Exactly.
That's what polite conversation means to me.
Look at the pocket watch.
Ooh, my stars.
I compared it, when I saw it the first time at Trevin, to Burn After Reading. Because it didn't hit me on any emotional level whatsoever. It just seemed like this surface value thing. And I love Burn After Reading. I think it's nihilistic and hilarious.
Yeah.
But after seeing it three times, this is way more soulful. And, again, Oscar Isaac.
Yeah,
he's amazing.
There's just something about...
He's amazing.
He's amazing. Yeah. I think all the musical performances are there to kind of... That's the soul of the film. And it's also when each character is the most human and vulnerable and likable.
Yeah.
Like each time he plays, I mean, when it opens with him in that coffee shop, you're just like, I like him. I like that guy. And then it immediately follows with him getting the shit kicked out of him. You don't understand why.
But then June pours her heart out on the stage and it cuts to him and he's like, what? What the fuck? Like, he thinks everything's about him. He
well,
yeah, it's
but
great.
That's exactly
what I'm saying.
Is that he works on stage and he doesn't work anywhere else. It's brilliant. Yeah.
And I love
it's
that.
Brilliant.
And I love that, you know, the difference between him and a lot of other artists is that he didn't make it. You know, like every other artist, you can say that. You can take that same criticism about a lot of artists. You could say that about Bob Dylan, frankly, which is, you know, inserted at one point.
But I think it does make a case for how many talented people out there are there in the world.
Right.
That are this fucking good that never went anywhere.
Yeah.
And this is, I'm going to bring this up because it's going right into that and I'm going to get out of it real quickly. But last year there was a movie by David Chase called Not Fade Away.
Yeah.
About a band from New Jersey trying to make it and they don't make it either. Late 60s thing. Great fucking movie. Great
and it's on Netflix streaming right now.
Not Fade Away.
Not Fade Away. All right. Well, that's our, that's the top half of our top 10 list. So we're going to start with 5 and go to 1 in the second half of the podcast. So we'll be back in a minute with more.